Yeah, sure. Yeah, do you need the mic? Or you can just...
Hello? Can anyone hear me? Yes? No? Maybe? Right, just a quick announcement. CompSoc tonight is the first student tech meetup of, well, the year. And it will be at about 6:45 through in the forum. Free pizza, everyone loves it. £2 if you're not a CompSoc member, and it's free if you are a CompSoc member. And you can join if you want to join us. You can come along and we'll get you all set up and stuff. The talks tonight are from Amazon. And they're talking about, I think it's code. Yeah. Skyscanner are talking about some acquisition that they've reached, I think Zoom something or other. And Searproc, who I think do speech synthesis. So it should be good. Free pizza. Who doesn't love it? And a chance to talk to everyone. All right. Cheers, guys.
Thank you.
Okay, sorry, it's taken me a bit longer than expected to get started. Before I get started on this, I've sent you all an email, so you probably had it. For the coursework, there's been a change in the submit program, which you might already have heard about from other courses, that involves not having to type in one of the arguments to the submit command. So when you submit your coursework next week, just make sure you follow the instructions. I've updated the document that's linked off the website, so it's got the correct string that you type in. Okay, so today we're going to talk about software design and hopefully get on to some refactoring. Let's just start with what design is. So when it comes to software, it's how you go about deciding how the software is going to meet the requirements. And that's a design process. And that doesn't usually include actually doing any coding. So design is something that you do before you do any coding. And you might ask, well, how do you know when you've got a good design? And that's a difficult question to answer. It's a bit like, you know, how long is a piece of string? One of the answers is it's hard to say, to give you sort of a recipe for good design, but you'll recognize it when you see it, which doesn't help you very much. So what we can do instead is give you some criteria for a good design. And so these are things that you probably want your design to kind of adhere to, but not necessarily in all cases. So first of all, it's got to meet the requirements, functional and non-functional. Secondly, it should be verifiable, and that can be anything from provably correct, you know, which would be an ideal situation, but you're very rarely able to achieve that, to some sort of testing. There's some kind of testing regime that you can undertake that will convince you that it is doing what it's supposed to do. A good design should be straightforward to explain to the people who have to code it up. So they should understand, you know, how it's structured, what the parts are, and what their role in the whole system is. And it should be easily maintainable, ideally easily maintainable, so that people who come along to the project later and have to fix things can also understand how it's set up. So a good design will meet all of those requirements, and many designs will use existing technology. So you don't want to be reinventing the wheel. You should use libraries and components whenever possible. And in most of these, it's not just a matter of coding or a matter of following a set procedure. There's sort of human judgment involved in almost all of these. So, does it meet the known requirements? That's a judgment call. The better specified the requirements are, the more precise you can be about it. But requirements aren't always as clear as you'd like them to be. So there's a lot of dependency on what sort of situation you're in. So, for example, the design will vary depending on whether you're going to implement it as a functional language or an object-oriented language. And some design choices will make it easy to make certain kinds of changes later, and other design choices will make it easy to make other kinds of changes later. And so you want to be thinking about what sort of changes are most likely. So again, this depends on the situation. So here's a quote about design. This is more generally about design, not specifically software design. Designers put things together and bring new things into being, dealing in the process with many variables and constraints, some initially known and some discovered through designing. Almost always, designers' moves have consequences other than those intended for them. So that's an important point. You start making a design and it makes you realize new things, and that makes you go back and iterate. Designers juggle variables, reconcile conflicting values, and maneuver around constraints. A process in which, although some design products may be superior to others, there are no unique right answers. So that's another good point, that given a set of requirements, there isn't a right answer. There isn't a correct design. There are a variety of different designs which will have advantages in one way or another over each other, and some of them may be clearly inferior, but you're very unlikely to have a correct design. And design needs to go on at all sorts of different levels. So, for example, what programming language are you going to use to implement this? What sort of subsystems are you going to have? How are you going to modularize? What sort of classes, if you're looking at the low-level design and it's an object-oriented, then what sort of classes are you going to have in your system? And what are the different levels? How do they interact? What are the responsibilities of the different levels? And what sort of interfaces do you have between them? And what sort of messages get exchanged between the different components in the system? So all of these aspects are aspects of that you have to go through when you're doing the design process. So architecture is one of the first things to look at, and that has all sorts of different meanings. But basically what underlies them all is, how do the components work together? What are the components and how do they work together? What's the structure? And you can have architectural decisions about structure and what the components are at all sorts of different levels. So the high level is what typically people mean when they talk about architecture, but it does pervade down into lower levels. And the architectural decisions are typically ones that you don't go back and revisit once the system's been implemented, or even in the middle of it being implemented, you don't go back and change your architectural decisions. So they're, to some extent, irrevocable. And the only the circumstance in which that's not true is when you might go and completely redo the system. So, for example, the electronic lab notebook that the company I work with produces was built as architected as a client-server application originally, and at some point a few years ago we decided to turn it into a web application, so it's delivered through a browser. I'm not sure what that is. And you know, that required a complete rewrite of the whole system, and that's the sort of thing that happens when you make a major architectural change. You're probably going to completely re-implement the whole system, and you may have a very similar requirement set, but it's a new system. So the sort of classic view on architecture is, what are the components, which means how are you going to divide up the space of the functionality? How are you going to say, okay, these functions go together, these other functions go together, or alternatively, this kind of data sits together, this other kind of data sits together? Those are the sorts of decisions that you need for components, and then how are they going to talk to each other? What's the means of the connections between them? And you know, obviously down at the class level, the way the components talk to each other is, if you're in a Java situation, it's through the interfaces. But at higher levels, you can also think about how components are connected. Okay, so these are some other examples of other architectural decisions. So what sort of component standard are you going to use? Java Beans, for example. What are the conventions about error handling? What framework does the system use? So, for example, is it going to be developed if it's Java, say, as a in the Spring framework, which provides a number of different kind of paradigms, and these are, you know, typically higher level choices. So, a good architecture will typically reuse components in different parts of it. And when you read about architectures and components, there's a little bit of, you know, it's not completely clear what's architecture and what's components. So some parts of the architecture can be components in themselves in some approaches to this. So and product line architectures are a particular example of that. So then once you have the high level design, then you can do detailed design. And so that's typically, if you're doing detailed design, you've got a set of requirements for a particular component that you're going to be implementing. And then you need to work out what are the how you're going to do that. And so you'll be given a set of interfaces that your subsystem has to work to. And then you have to decide what are the classes that you're going to provide and what's the behavior that will provide the functionality for those interfaces. So the idea with this sort of way of doing design is that you're breaking it down into different subtasks. And so even if it's a really huge project, the overall project is broken down into smaller ones that are kind of manageable by a single person or a small team. Okay, so let's take a look at just an example of design at a see if I can get this thing. We'll take a look at an example in an area that you're quite familiar with. Where are we? Here we go. So you need number 51. And I should be able to do that. Okay, so I'm going to give you some options here. Okay, so this is a Java class, not the whole of a Java class, obviously. So we've got a class address book, and we're going to implement the address book as a linked list, which we call the addresses. And then we need to have methods to add things to this address book and take them away and so on. So there's a method add to add to the address book, and it just calls the add method for the linked list. Okay, so that's one way of doing things. This one. Okay, so here's another way of doing this. So we've got the same class, but in this case it's going to extend the linked list. So it's a subclass of linked list. And then obviously we don't need to write a method to add to it because linked list has a method, so we just inherit that. Okay, so those are your two options. And that's another option, that both of them are fine. And they certainly both will work. And the fourth option is, I don't know. So let's, I'll start this. Okay. All right, I think everybody's probably clicked by now, so I'll stop this. Okay, so what have we got here? Most people prefer B. So what's this? 15 for B, 10 for A. 4 say it's both are fine, and 3 don't know. Okay, so what I'd like to do now is if somebody who thought that B was the right way to do things, since that's the most popular, would somebody like to just give an explanation very briefly, you know, like, why is B better than A? Anybody? You don't need to write the code. Well, it's certainly, there's less typing to do, that's for sure. Whether the Java system is going to end up using more or less space depends on how the virtual machine's implemented, and you might save a little bit of space, but it's not that much. Okay. All right. So I don't really want to be commenting on these. That wasn't what I meant to do here. So that's good. Now, what I'd like to do is, if somebody who picked class A would like to give me a reason why that's better, or give everybody a reason, actually, because I want you all to vote again. Okay. All right. So what I'd like to do now is just rerun this quickly. We'll just vote on this again. And if I can find the, here we go. Am I able to do this again? Oh, I have to close this, don't I? Okay. I'll give you till 10 seconds, I'm sure that's enough. Did everybody vote the same way? Okay, so nobody managed to convince anybody else. Oh no, there are more people and both are fine. Okay, and more people don't know. One more person doesn't know. Okay, good. Right, let me just get rid of that. Okay, so why is this not doing what I want? Here we go. Right, okay, so the correct answer is A. Where are we?
Why?
Is A. And the reason is more or less what was said by the person who was defending A. What you're doing here is you're basically saying an address book is a linked list. It's a sort of special kind of linked list, which means that if you ever decide you don't want to use a linked list for your address book, let's say your address book gets huge, I mean really, really big, then you might need a database for it. You know, a linked list. The way you search a linked list is you go down the linked list. If it gets really long, it's not going to be efficient. So a linked list might not always be the best way to implement it. If you've implemented it with the way it's done with in B, as say extending the linked list, then everywhere where you've used this class as in the system, you're going to have to go and check that you've got the right method. So you're going to have to provide potentially all the methods of linked list for whatever new implementation you offer. I mean, another thing you might do is you might, instead of a linked list, you might use a hash map. That would be a very obvious thing to do. You can use a hash map keyed on the person's name. And again, now hash map and linked list have mostly, you know, the same sort of methods, but they're not identical. So basically what it does is it creates too much interdependence between this class and this class, an interdependence that isn't, there's no need for it. And it is tempting to do this because, as you said, you know, there's less typing, it sort of, it looks cleaner somehow. You know, what is all this junk up here when I can, I just don't need any of it. But actually it's not cleaner. This is a much cleaner way to do things. And in fact, have you all studied interfaces in Java? You must have studied interfaces in Java last year, no? Not how many people are familiar with interfaces? So most, but well, about half. Okay. I'll have to do something about interfaces then. But basically, for people who know about interfaces, a good way to do this would be to say, class address book implements a particular interface, and then you've got a specification in the interface of exactly what this class needs to provide. And then you divorce the, then you're keeping things separate. Now, and all of that requires more typing and, you know, more files, because you've got a file for the interface class. So it's actually more work to get it set up. But the whole system becomes much more maintainable. Okay, so now when you did your Java class last year, did you talk about coherence and coupling? Those things. Okay, so sorry, it's not something you've come across. Okay, so. I was going to run this as a question, but since you don't know the answer, I think I'll just go through it. So the coherence of a component, which in Java refers to typically a class or a package, but you can think of more generally in a design. You know, these are some of the things that you might think coherence means. You know, how similar the parts of the component are, the degree to which a component reflects a functional abstraction, how clear the organization of the component is, or how much interaction there is within the component. And in system design, coherence refers to B, the degree to which the component reflects a functional abstraction. So a component is coherent if it encapsulates some functionality that you know, makes sense from the point of view of the system. And okay, and a better design will have higher coherence. So in other words, you know, this component implements this kind of functionality, this component implements this other kind of functionality. They may need to use each other's services, but that's all. Okay, and then similarly, coupling between two components is the degree of interaction or dependency, the degree of interaction between the components, or the extent to which one component depends on the other. So it's not dependent on the implementation of the other component, but actually on the other component. And coupling, and that what we saw before with the two implementations of address book as an example of coupling between the classes, that the B was an example of two greater coupling. So what you want is low coupling. So if you had to pick two design principles, and there are lots of different design principles, then the two that you would pick is to maximize the coherence and minimize coupling. And you might ask, why pick those? And the reason to pick those is because those things are checkable both by people and particularly by software tools. So in Java, the compiler can check things to do with coupling, what class depends on what other class. And it, you know, if you in Eclipse, it will tell you that there are dependencies that aren't satisfied if you haven't implemented things properly. So the compiler can check the dependencies, and if you keep functionality that belongs together in one place and you minimize interactions as much as possible, then it becomes easier to maintain the system, because if you need to work, if there's some problem with one component, the chances are good that you can work on that without having to work on a whole lot of other components. Okay, so other design principles, and you can look at the Software Engineering Book of Knowledge to read about this in chapter 3. Abstraction is a good thing. So abstraction is basically picking out the commonalities between a lot of what look like different situations and dealing with those commonalities and ignoring the differences. So if you can do that, that's a good thing to do. Modularization is a good thing, so breaking things up. So you place different functionalities or responsibilities is another way of putting it in different components. Encapsulation is slightly different from modularization. The two go together, but encapsulation means hiding away the details of how a module is implemented. So the module delivers an interface, and that's the only thing the rest of the world needs to know about it. It doesn't, so the address book, for example, no other class should need to know whether it's implemented as a linked list or a hash map or there's a database behind it. It just delivers its interface. And separating the interface and implementation, as I suggested, having an interface for the address book would be an advantage as well. And then, of course, you need to have the set of modules that you come up with need to be sufficient. They need to provide all the functionality, and ideally they're the simplest that could do that, although you can never know for sure that you've got the simplest solution. So interfaces are key to all of that. And the whole idea with all of these principles is that you're trying to build a complex system that's actually too complex to really comprehend in its totality. And it's a way of kind of breaking things down so that we can understand it. Okay, now let's talk about modeling a little bit, because we're going to talk about UML next time. So a model is, and for software engineering, is any precise representation of some or most of the information needed to solve a problem using a computer. And the kind of operative words there are precise and representation. So it isn't the program that's going to actually solve the problem. It's a representation of the program. So it's some representation of, say, what are the classes, what are they going to do? And UML has a set of diagrams. That's the way you represent the model. And it's stored, it can be stored textually as XML. And it has a particular language, so you have to obey the rules of the language. And it has a fairly precise meaning, but not completely precise. If it was completely precise, then you could take the UML model and generate code with it, and that's just, that's your software. But although people are increasingly doing that sort of thing, UML models typically don't have enough to, do the whole job. And UML is also designed to be used informally, so you can use it as the basis of a discussion. Okay, so the reason that we do this designing and modeling is so that you can you design so you can build a system that's got the right properties, and you model so that you can talk about the design and communicate about it. And one of the ways of going about this is to do a lot of design up front. And that's sort of the traditional way of doing things. Big design up front. Quite often, you don't have any choice about that. You know, if you're developing a safety critical system, then you better spend a lot of time on design right away. Or if you've got a very large team because the system's got to get delivered quickly and it's big, then you're going to have to do a lot of design so that the team all work together. If it's done right and in the right sort of circumstances, then it simplifies development and saves rework. Even if it's done right, but in the wrong sort of circumstances, like the requirements are changing too fast, then it doesn't necessarily save work. So the extent to which you want to invest effort in the design at the beginning of the project depends very much on the context. What is the project? You know, how fast is the environment changing? And of course, you're never going to get everything right. So you have to have ways of dealing with the fact that your design, some aspects of your design probably weren't right. And it's potentially quite wasteful because you spend all this time doing design rather than building systems. So the alternative, you know, kind of, and there's everything in between, but the alternative is to do a very simple design, the simplest thing you can think of that will probably work, start building it, and you just refactor a lot. Have you come across this term refactoring? Yeah, okay, so you know sort of vaguely what it means. I'll talk about refactoring possibly a little bit today. But the extreme programming idea is, or one of the ideas is, you know, whatever you, when someone says, well, we should include this, you just say, no, we're not going to need that. And so you try to hone in on what is the absolute essence of this, of the requirements of the system that you're building. What's the minimum I can get away with? So you're not going to need it. Do the simplest thing that could possibly work. And what you're essentially doing by doing that is saying, I'm confident that, you know, A, this isn't going to be enough, but I'm going to be able to recover from that later. So, you know, I'll create something in a couple of weeks, ship it out, people come back and go, oh, that's no good. You know, we need this, that, and the other. Great. I'll spend another week, give them another iteration. You know, they'll come back. Another week, give them another iteration. That's the idea. And, you know, it turns out that in a lot of circumstances, that's a good way to go. I keep picking up the wrong one. Okay, so that's pretty much all on design. There's some quite a lot of reading that you can do about this, and you should definitely do some of it. And here's a couple of quotes for you about design. So the first one just, you know, tells you that it's not clear what design really is. And the second one is how important design can be. Okay, let's go on, and I'll start on refactoring and then finish off next time. Right, so refactoring is the process of reorganizing and rewriting code so that it's cleaner and it fits better into the current idea of the architecture. So refactoring doesn't change the functionality, it just reorganizes how the functionality is delivered. And refactoring used to be thought of as a kind of maintenance. So, I mean, for example, if you've you know, you come into a project and there's a whole lot of code and it's just a real mess. Well, you're going to, you know, one of the things you're going to want to do, if you've got time, is to reorganize it so that it's less of a mess, so that you can work with it. Or if there's a new requirement comes in, so that you're going to have to change the architecture in some way, then you may find that requires you to reorganize. So those are all, you know, maintenance kinds of issues. But it, as I said, it can also be an integral part of the development process. So in extreme programming, the idea is not just that you keep delivering, you know, more functionality or new functionality or modifying it every week, but alongside that, in parallel with that, you keep reorganizing the code. And it's very important when you go through that sort of process to be quite clear about what you're doing. Are you refactoring, in which case you're not adding functionality or taking it away, you're just refactoring, or are you providing new functionality or changing the functionality? And you don't want to mix those two things up, because you can get very confused and testing becomes a problem then if you mix those things up. Okay. So refactoring is typically small transformations. It's not you know, great big reorganizations. And there's some good examples on the web at this web address, which refers to the refactoring book. So you can look at the catalog. But some of the examples, there's a very large number of them. Some of the examples are sort of quite fairly simple. So for example, you add a parameter to a method that allows you to reorganize how things are done. If you've got two objects or two classes that refer to each other, then if you don't need the, probably they were set up that way because you needed them to refer to each other initially. But if you see that you no longer need that, then it's a good idea to get rid of that bidirectional association. So you change it to unidirectional. You can introduce an explaining variable. So for example, if you've got a complex if statement, you know, if this condition and this condition and this condition and this condition and this condition, each of those conditions is probably, you know, maybe a test of, you know, this variable is equal to the result of a method call on this object. And it may not be entirely obvious by just reading something like that what each of these conditions is. So what you can do is you can create a variable that has the value of each of those conditions, and then you can give that a meaningful name, which corresponds to what this condition is testing. So that's an example of an explaining variable. A slightly more sophisticated refactoring is to replace a conditional with a polymorphism. So in an example of this is if you have a set of objects that are of a particular class, and they're actually different kinds of things. So you have a field in the class that says what the type of the object is, and you say, and then you have a method that says, if it's this type of object, I do this, if it's this other type of object, I do that. You can replace that by subclassing, so each of those different kinds of objects gets has its own implementation for the method, and then Java's polymorphism will take care of making sure the right method gets executed. So that makes the system cleaner. So when you do refactoring, you apply a sequence of these small transformations, and you don't add any functionality. So Eclipse has a built-in refactoring tool, and it would be good for you to get familiar with that. And it has operations of three classes. And I may give show you an example of this next time. But the first class is just simply the kind of physical organization, what the, you know, files and so on. So you can rename and move files, and Eclipse will then update your package statements and your import statements and so on, so the right things get imported. So that's nice. You can rename variables and rename methods, and Eclipse will go through the whole source and rename everything in every file that needs to do that. You can move classes between packages, and again, that means that the importing and so on will get handled for you. So that's all really convenient if you need to move things around. So there are much larger changes that reorganize the way classes relate. And they, you don't use them so much, but when you do, they can be very effective. So for example, when an anonymous class gets too big, you'll probably remember what an anonymous class is, one that's declared, you know, kind of on the spot where it's used and doesn't get a name. So these things over time, they probably start out quite small because they're focused on a particular kind of functionality. And over time, they can accrete more capability and get bigger and bigger. And if they get to be too big, then it's time to take some of that functionality out and put it into a nested class. So what you want to do is keep the anonymous classes small and focused. You can move methods and fields up and down the class hierarchy, and sometimes you need to do that, and it can make things a lot simpler, but that's a bigger change. And if a class, in some circumstances, you may have a class where you don't have an interface. I mean, it's not the case that every class is implemented with an interface, but you may find that you need to create one for that class. Okay, and then the third kind of refactoring that Eclipse supports is the kind that you'll do quite a lot, which is simplifying things within a particular class. So if a method gets too big, too long, you'll probably find that you can extract code from within that method and put it in a helper method. You may find that if you haven't set up accessor methods for fields, then that you probably want to do that. You can change the type of a method, the signature. So these are all things that you do just within one class. Okay, let's see what we've got next. Yeah, I think I'm going to leave it at that. And we'll finish off refactoring, look at UML next time, and I'll try and bring you some examples of refactoring. Send me the email. Right. Have you tried loading them into Eclipse, or what have you done? Okay. Well, if you can load it into Eclipse, then you can run from within Eclipse. Well, if it's a library that is used by other systems, is it a library that's used? No.
It's a complete system that, I don't know, SVN checkout, that's how you can download straight off certain sites.
Yeah.
You do that, and I've done this for like six projects. get all the source, get the code, but there's you can't run because it's not made. And the code is there, but I have no idea how to use it. Well, is there...
Okay, why don't you send me an example of one of these and I'll take a look at it. Yeah. You know, one of the simplest one you've got.
Building up the program on your clips.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I have the build.xml file on my, like, when I download it.
Yeah.
But then, like, I don't know how to, like, edit on your clips and stuff.
Okay, it should, what you should get is a complete package that you load the whole lot into Eclipse, and then Eclipse will the build file should be seen by Eclipse. So I mean, if you downloaded the build file separately,
no,
it was all in one, and Eclipse isn't finding it.
No, it's not.
Okay.
So it's basically filed and then export.
In Eclipse.
Yeah.
Well, you should be able to if you're trying to run it, you should be able to run it from within Eclipse. If you want to export it as a jar file, then yeah, it's I think it's file export.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's for the jar file. Yeah. But if you want to run it, you can run from within Eclipse.
Alright, okay. I
do. And Eclipse should. Why don't you send me the name of this? Did you send me the name
yes,
of the project?
I did.
Okay, yeah, I'll take a look at it and see.
I've actually got it. Should I bring it to?
Sorry?
I've got the project with me right now. Should I just bring it to?
Well, I've got a lot of things I've got to go and do. I don't have time now. I'll take a look at it, and then I might ask you to come and see me.
All right.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay. Hi.
Yeah. Oh, in addition.
I don't know, because it's not fully active. I went on the forum.
Yeah.
And the people doing it, there are a couple of bugs. It has more than one admin.
Yeah.
Bugs and maintenance bugs. But the files, it's a J password safe thing, so it's sort of complex. And one of the things they did want was documentation, so would you give up a web page and the tutorials on how to work it? And would that be acceptable?
What sort of things were you going to do?
The basic things they wanted, in addition to like maybe a tutorial with the screenshot.
Tutorial
to
for users,
yeah,
not
users,
for developers.
Not
yeah.
For developers, for users.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how I'd add it for developers, because I was looking at the code. It seems fairly straightforward, some of it, but it is a little complex.
Right.
For my coding level, so it would take.
Yeah.
Well,
it would be better if you could find something, a simpler project that you could do some coding on. And you know, the simpler projects may only have one author.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and if that's the case, I think it would be better to do a single developer project.
There's another one I was looking at. It was a vocabulary learning tool.
Mm-hmm.
To help you add the words. It seemed really good, but it was single author. We specifically said multiple.
Yeah, well, I mean, if it's a choice between, that would be,
mm-hmm.
I would rather you did that.
Some of the bugs and stuff they wanted in there were pretty complex. And
yeah, yeah.
Wasn't particularly active, so I would have to go change my project now too.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's fine. Why don't you do that?
Change the
yeah.
Okay.
So I'll send me an email and I'll
uh-huh.
remove your
okay.
Your line.
Okay. Because this project was a lot more fascinating because I like the security part of it and I get to look at the algorithms.
Right.
For a computer screen. But that's the thing.
Have you thought about just writing some tests for some of it? We haven't been through unit tests yet, but
I've done fairly basic because I've done a little bit of software engineering in high school. They went through the process and went to programs. I've done very bare basic stuff like black box and things like that, but nothing I don't know, honestly, like building tests for the algorithms.
Well, typically what you do is you build tests for each class.
Mm-hmm.
You'll will have
mm-hmm.
some test methods.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, some of the classes will be quite sophisticated and
yes,
but some of them will
but some of them will
probably be simpler.
Mm-hmm.
So you could write test methods for some of the simpler classes. It doesn't mean you have to write tests that test the whole thing.
Okay.
You can write tests that
And
I mean, if the project interests you more, then it's probably better to work on that.
That's the one thing. It was way more interesting than the vocabulary test was fairly. It was they'd had good documentation for it. The code was well maintained.
Yeah.
The code in this is a little harder to read, but the project overall is a lot more interesting than